Live Daily with Adrian Childs.
It's 2211. Should we be reassured or concerned by a huge rise in the number of people going to the police in England and Wales to report domestic abuse? A report out today shows that recorded cases rose 31% between 2013 and 2015, up to 353,000. Her Majesty's Inspector of Constabulary says the rise could be partly due to better recording by police and forces actively encouraging victims to come forward, but it warns it's led to excessive workloads and affected the quality and speed of investigations in some forces. Assistant Chief Constable Louisa Rolfe is the National Police Chiefs Council National Lead for Domestic Abuse.
Many forces are working really hard to prioritise this, so there are new officers are being trained. Many forces are investing more in their specialist teams, but also fundamentally we're making sure that every frontline officer has the right skills and the right tools available to them to deal with this effectively, because not every case will go to a specialist team. So I think we're stretched, but we're not overwhelmed.
If you've been to the police about an abusive partner, say, how was your case handled? Was action taken? Did they help you get out of the relationship safely? Perhaps they just made things worse. Do text 85058 or call 0500 999693 if you can share your story with our listeners. Zoe Billingham is from HMIC, which wrote today's report. It seemed odd to... I began by saying that this... Should we be reassured or concerned? But which should it be,
as far Morning, as you're concerned? Agent. Morning, Adrian. Yeah, no, it is odd, isn't it? We're saying that there's a 31% increase in crime, and we're saying that it's a good thing. The reason for that is we think that the police are now actually recording this crime properly. So victims have been coming forwards, but their crimes haven't been recorded. Now, of course, if the crime isn't recorded, that's not going to trigger any police action. So victims of domestic abuse won't be being kept safe by the police. They won't be going after the perpetrator, and they won't be bringing that perpetrator to justice. So it is important that victims come forward, and it's really important that the police respond appropriately. The first stage in that is recording the crime.
And who's to say, and how does one measure how well they are dealing with it once the crime has been recorded?
Well, that's our job, really. We go into forces. We've done all 43 over the last 6 months, and we spend time in forces. We don't just listen to what the chief constable tells us. We go and talk to frontline officers. We turn up unannounced at stations. We listen to recordings of calls into call handlers on 999 calls. What we want to know is, are the police listening to victims? Do they understand domestic abuse? And are they providing the right response? Because victims tell us, and we spoke to lots of victims as part of this inspection, that when a police officer who really understands this issue crosses the threshold into their home, they then know that they're going to be kept safe. And it's about attitudes, it's about culture. But it's also, as Louisa was saying, making sure that police officers are properly trained and really do understand some of the complexities of this most abhorrent crime.
Surely part of the proof of the pudding is in the number of convictions, or at least the number of times charges are pressed. Now, if there were 353,000 reports, cases of reported domestic abuse, but that's astonishing. That's a huge number.
It is.
How does that tally to the number of convictions, say? Does that run into thousands? Do you have those numbers at your fingertips?
I don't have all the numbers at my fingertips, Adrian, but you make a really good point. In some forces, where there's a domestic abuse crime, the number of times that an offender is brought to justice is kind of like around one in five times. Now, in some instances, crimes will be resolved in different ways, so they won't actually result in an offender going to court and then being convicted. But we're really clear in this report. What we're saying is when the police turn up a domestic abuse crime, their first duty is to keep the victim safe, and then they have to decide whether or not they're going to arrest. And our view is that unless there's good reason not to arrest, they should be arresting the perpetrator, taking that decision off the victim, because quite often we find that police officers sort of listen to victims when perhaps they say, actually, I don't want him arrested, because it often is that the victim's a woman. But that's misunderstanding the complexities of some of these relationships that police officers are walking into. Their job is to go in, keep the victim safe. If a crime has been committed, arrest, and then make sure that you deal with the victim in an appropriate and a respectful way afterwards. And then she may want to press charges, and that will then be the first stage of her removing herself, empowering herself to get out of an abusive relationship.
Okay, thank you, Zoe. Zoe Billingham from the HMIC, which wrote today's report. Earlier, I spoke to Chloe Winfield, who's 17 years old. She went to the police to report emotional abuse by a former partner.
I met my ex-boyfriend online through Twitter, through, like, we're both fans of the same TV show, and that's how we got talking when I was 13, nearly 14. And
what TV show was it?
Waterloo Road. I ran like a fan page for them, and he was like a fan of the show, and that's sort of how we got in touch.
Okay, so you communicated online for how long?
A year before we met face to face for the first time. I was nearly 15 when we met face to face.
Right, and soon you were boyfriend and girlfriend.
Yeah, we were boyfriend and girlfriend online for a bit, and then I broke up with him because I went into hospital and I couldn't really have any contact with him. But then after I came out of hospital, we sort of got back together and met up face to face.
And how long did it take for it to start going wrong?
When I'd broken up with him the first time, he sort of flipped and started being really horrible and sort of calling me names and sending a lot of nasty texts. And before, he'd always been sort of very intense but always very nice. And then it sort of gradually got worse after we started meeting. He was sort of hurting himself a lot, like self-harming and saying it was my fault. He said I'd completely ruined his life by breaking up with him, even though at that point we'd never even met face to face. And it sort of escalated from there. He got more and more controlling and manipulative.
But this was sort of verbal abuse and online abuse still?
Yeah, it was mostly over the phone and online. He was normally much nicer when we actually met face to face.
So when you went to the police, what did you say to them?
When I went to the police, so the first time, he'd been like, well, he'd been shouting at me in public and he had threatened to fine me and stab me and sort of hurt me and stuff. And I reported that and that I was concerned he was talking to other young girls as well and that's why he was going to do the same thing to someone else. And I sort of said that he'd been threatening me and that I was quite sort of scared of him. They said they could warn him, but I didn't think that would help because I was worried I'd just get a backlash from him and he'd sort of take it as a, okay, well, this isn't actually like a crime, so I can carry on. And so they noted it all down, but it wasn't a criminal sort of thing, it wasn't a crime. And then they left it and I stayed in contact with him.
But sooner or later, though, he wasn't going to change his behaviour unless he did hear from the police, which at some level must have been your purpose in going to the police.
Yeah, so after things escalated quite a bit more after that, and then I did go back to the police a second time, and that's when he was arrested. He had bail conditions not to contact me, which he broke and stayed in touch with me, but then eventually he pleaded guilty to harassment, and after he was convicted he got a 5-year restraining order not to have any contact with me, and that's worked, so I haven't heard from him since he had the restraining order.
So in the end you got there with the police?
Yeah, in the end. It was quite difficult, especially the second time I went back. They didn't really take it very seriously because a lot of it had been online, and they sort of were saying it wasn't harassment, although he was really sort of on at me all the time and like sort of calling me like constantly, like sort of 30 calls in a row and a lot of sort of screaming and threatening me. But because I'd answered his messages, because I was sort of scared not to, they initially said that they wouldn't be able to arrest him. So it was quite a battle, but it did eventually get there.
But surely if it's online abuse, there is evidence of it, because there's not a paper trail, there's kind of an electronic paper trail, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, a lot of it was on Ask.fm, the anonymous messaging website, and they don't cooperate with the police very well, so that was difficult to get evidence of. But also I think police officers don't always understand that online abuse is really serious as well, so they don't sort of realise the impact that it can have on someone and that it is actually quite sort of real when it's happening to you.
I know this is easier said than done, but if you just stopped contact, blocked his emails, blocked him on whatever social media you're using, and not taken his phone calls, what would the outcome of that have been?
he always found another way to contact me. So he'd get, like, he'd create new email addresses and find new websites sort of to contact me through, new, like, profiles if I blocked his old ones. And I was sort of quite frightened that not talking to him might sort of drive him to try and confront me face to face, like if he didn't have that sort of outlet to get angry at me. And I think as well, like when you've been in a relationship like that for quite a long time, it's really difficult to stop talking to someone like that because it is such a huge part of your life and you sort of feel responsible for them.
That's Chloe Winfield. Listening to that is Rachel Horman, a domestic abuse lawyer at Walter Ramsbottom in Lancashire, and the chair of Paladin, a service which supports victims of stalking. Oh, have I pronounced that right, Rachel?
Paladin, yes. Yeah. It's the National Stalking Advocacy Service.
Now, in the case we've just heard, I know you weren't involved in that, but generally, how typical would that be? What could the police have done differently, in your view?
It's very typical, unfortunately. We find that online behaviour in particular just isn't taken very seriously at all by the police. That type of behaviour could be prosecuted as harassment or stalking, and all too often it isn't. Victims are often advised, well, just stop going on social media, and that's totally unrealistic. It's a bit like in the 70s when the Yorkshire Ripper was around and women were told, well, don't go out at night. It's unacceptable, really, to restrict the victim's life in that way. But all too common, that's what we're hearing. And that can actually put the victim at more risk. As we heard, it can actually escalate the situation where the perpetrator will find other means to contact the victim and then perhaps even start turning up in real life, not just online.
Yeah, but what she said she didn't want to happen is the police to contact the man involved. Whereas, I mean, you know, that's totally her call, but I wonder what the best advice is there, because there's a halfway point between charging somebody or arresting somebody and doing nothing, which might be, I don't know, even email and visit him, you know, a shot across the bows. Look, cut it out or we're going to be on to you. Would that do more harm than good?
It can do. And I think there's far too much reliance on the victim in situations like this, where we're looking at situations where the victim has been coercively controlled over some time by her partner. She's not in a great position to make a decision about that, perhaps doesn't understand the whole process and what that involves. And as we heard earlier, the attitude of the police officer at day one can really affect that. And if the victim is really supported, then they're far more likely to agree to support the prosecution. But at the end of the day, that shouldn't be a decision for the victim. That should be taken out of the victim's hands. The police are the ones there to decide whether or not a crime has taken place. They should be looking at whether there's sufficient evidence with the help of the Crown Prosecution Service. And if there is, then, you know, these perpetrators should be prosecuted. This is a repeat crime. It's the biggest repeat crime there is. And we also see that these perpetrators will then move on to another victim. So it really does need to be dealt with in a severe way.
So how bad has it got to be before the CPS will be reasonably confident of getting some kind of result?
Well, unfortunately, pretty bad, it seems, with domestic abuse and stalking. I think the police come in for a lot of criticism and, you know, we do see bad practice all too often. But it does hide the fact that even where the police are looking at other evidence and trying to compile a case, quite often the CPS are the ones that will then come back and say insufficient evidence. I've had clients that have had visible bruising on them and been told by the CPS that there's insufficient evidence, and to me that is just unacceptable. It seems that all that needs to happen is for the perpetrator to claim self-defence when in fact they have no injuries whatsoever. And the CPS quite often will say insufficient evidence.
Okay, well, if bruises aren't going to lead to the CPS to decide to take any action, then what about a paper trail, which is, again, I use the wrong expression, but what about, yeah, you know, persistent abuse on social media, which can be, you know, terribly traumatic? Yes. Are those cases ever brought? How bad's that got to be before something happens?
They are brought to court. occasionally, but it really is the minority, and it does have to be pretty bad, to be honest. And if there's any suggestion that the victim has contacted the perpetrator back, like we heard from the last victim, then again, very often, the CPS will say, well, you know, you were having a conversation with him, when it's quite clear that the vast majority of the messages from the victim are simply saying, look, can you stop contacting me? But in cases like that, very often, again, they will say insufficient evidence. I think it's just not taken seriously, and that they see it as something that doesn't impact on the victim, which it clearly does, and that makes me concerned about what will happen on the 29th of December this year when we have the new offence of coercive control, because that's exactly what I think will happen with that.
OK, we'll talk again, I'm sure, Rachel. Fascinating speaking to you. Rachel Horman, domestic abuse lawyer from Walter Ramsbottom in Lancashire and chair of Paladin, a service which supports victims of stalking. Let's just have a police and crime commissioner for Essex. Nick, yours was one of the four forces, along with Bedfordshire, Staffordshire and Surrey, rated inadequate in this service research by HMIC in this report in dealing with domestic abuse. How do you react to that?
Well, Adrian, you know, with immense disappointment, you know, I know how much work has been going on within Essex Police to improve their performance in this area, with not only domestic abuse, but also with missing persons, with child sex exploitation, which are the three areas that were looked at by HMIC, by the inspectorate. So immensely disappointing to find that there's still, you know, a long way to go. This is a tough journey. Step by step, Essex Police is improving. But we've seen from the report that, you know, how difficult it is and how difficult it is to get right. But very, very committed, ongoing commitment to get it right.
What steps will you take?
Well, the steps that we've been taking, Adrian, really for the last, two years plus, holding, you know, my role, holding the Chief Constable to account, so understanding what's going on in the force, encouraging him, thinking about the shift of resources. We've moved very large amount of resources from local policing into these specialist areas, around £10 million of resource last year moved into it, another £3.5 million this year. So it's about resource, it's about training. This is it's about putting right, I would say, probably, you know, years of underinvestment. I won't say neglect, but years of underinvestment in things like training the detectives, making this a truly valued part of policing. I want the very best police officers to want to go into these areas, looking after those who are vulnerable, whether they're children or missing persons or people in relationships.
Okay. Well, a police officer from Coventry has been in touch with, I don't know, you can't comment on different force, but he makes the point, says that it's a joke. Government's been slashing police numbers on the basis that crimes are falling. As a serving officer, I can tell you my workload's massively increased to an unmanageable level, and now what a surprise that we can't cope. Would you have any sympathy with that view?
Not hugely, and not necessarily with the way it's expressed. Are police officers under great pressure? Yes, they are, and I'm very conscious that, you know, the officers in Essex are under great pressure. But, you know, the Chief Constable has said he's not going to make, you know, resourcing an issue for not doing this most important work as well as possible. Are some areas of policing suffering as a result of resources going into these high-risk areas? Yes. And are officers having to work really hard? Yes, they are, and I respect them for it. Yeah. But, you know, I don't think you can make the excuses about resourcing for reasons why an officer doesn't ask the right question. When a young teenager returns to a children's home on Monday, you know, it's not a question of resourcing, about asking the questions about where they've been, what they've been doing, and taking those answers really seriously.
Okay, Nick. Okay, we'll leave it there. Nick Alston, thanks very much indeed. PCC for the Essex Force. It's just coming up to 11 o'clock, so you know.